Hello and welcome to the Eat PhD Team podcast, the podcast here to help you with your relationship with food and body by giving you evidence-based techniques to support yourself with a sprinkling of feminism, a dash of dismantling diet culture and a side of vulnerability as we share our own messy lives with you. I'm Emilia, a registered nutritionist and PhD with the sole purpose of making your life happier and healthier. If you love it, please do go wild and share it. And if you're ready for support with our coaching, details are in the show notes. Hello and welcome to episode number 306 of the ETPHD Team Podcast with myself and Anna. Hi Anna, how are you?
Hello, I am great, thanks. Mercury is up the microwave and I am feeling so much lighter.
I was feeling lighter until like 10 minutes ago and then I got riled at myself and now I'm, and my lightness is, my lightness has been overshadowed by my internal frustration, but I'm sure that that will pass within about 5 minutes. It's fine. It's on.
Breeze.
You know what I rediscovered this week? Müller pots, the ones that have like the chocolate bits on one side and then the yogurt on the other.
Yeah, what's it called? Corner yogurts.
Yes.
Is that it? Yes.
Rediscovered.
Oh, that's like childhood.
Mm-hmm. Yesterday I had the one that was like banana yogurt with like chocolate corny flake bits, and then just before the pod I had the one with like the little tiny little chocolate and white chocolate balls and like the vanilla yogurt.
There's like an orangey one, isn't there? Oh, you did this yesterday with the binge, like chocolate orange, but you did this yesterday with the ice cream also. I just need some food.
I am talking about food quite a lot at the moment, and it's not because I'm preoccupied by food, just because I'm always hungry and I'm always eating. So therefore, and I'm very much in that phase of like, oh, I really fancy that, so I'll have it. And sometimes it's something really obscure that, like those Müller corners, I probably haven't had since I was like, I don't actually know, because we didn't even really get them when we were kids, so I've not had them for a very long time, and they're just delicious.
Yeah, that is proper. That was like a childhood treat.
So I've got the other half of that to eat after the podcast because I ran out of time and didn't want to rush it, so that's gonna be an exciting post-podcast treat for me. It's a great day. Internal rage is already dissipating somewhat, although not fully. You know when you just hear the voices in your head, even when you're talking you can hear the voices in your head, that's called not being present. So maybe when you're talking,
do you need a mindful moment?
Probably do. Like, you know, when you do the mindful moment where you literally breathe in fresh air into your brain and you imagine it like swirling around your brain and like clearing it all out. That's my favorite. That's what I probably need to do.
I was talking to a client earlier, and thankfully she understood the reference, but I was talking about how, well, this like how journaling, you know, like in Harry Potter when they take out like the memory, and I was like, that for me is what like journaling is, like getting that thought out on paper. And she's like, yes, I see that.
I like that one a lot. I love any visual representation of mindfulness. I think it's such a, yeah, it's such a really helpful way to think about it, and it's sort of active, you know, it's sort of like with the clouds. I used to do that when I was a kid, and I didn't, like, I think I've said this before and I didn't know what it was. I think if you have children and you want to help them like develop mindfulness, explaining things to them like the Harry Potter wand, or where you say something, you know, like every time you breathe in, when you breathe out, use the Harry Potter wand to like get your thoughts out of your head. And again, it's not, obviously mindfulness is not about never thinking, but just that what's the word? You are not your thoughts, like that dissociation slightly from your thoughts. I think I put a video on Instagram this morning, and you saw this obviously when we were in Malta last week. My baby loves yoga, so every time I do yoga,
that was wild.
He's like jumping out of my skin. So obviously I've decided that he's just going to be like this zen yogi meditative baby. That's exactly what's going to happen.
I can 100% see it, just like absolutely chilling in a little sling around you.
Yeah, all the time. Yeah. Just meditating in the corner. That's exactly what he's going to be like. Okay, I'm going to sneeze and then we'll do the question.
Cool.
Excuse me.
Bless you.
Oh, okay, thanks. Do you want to go first with the questions?
Yes. Okay. Can't relate. Have you ever pressured yourself to inaction, or is that just me?
Pressures yourself into inaction. What does that mean? You tell me.
I guess like my understanding of it is almost kind of maybe perfectionism leading to procrastination because you're worried that it's not going to
Oh.
be good enough.
Okay, that's what I thought. Just wanted to be sure.
Yeah.
I don't know if it was like enforced rest. I do it. I used to do it a lot more than I do now because I run multiple businesses now. I cannot afford to not take action. And I don't know if this person's a coach, if they work with you. So they're a coach. So like the reality is, if you run your own business, you cannot afford to do that. It's as simple as that. And I had a conversation with someone this morning actually about some ideas for moving things forward with their business, and they said, okay, well, yeah, maybe next month, like, we could talk about this. And I was like, well, why don't we just do this now? And sometimes we all do that, right? It's like we think, oh, I need to think this thing over, and then we think something over in our head and it becomes this big thing, and then we think about how we need to talk about it, and then we need to think about how we act to action it. And then a month's gone by and we've had it on our list for a month to think about doing X, Y, or Z, and a month's gone by, we haven't taken any action. So there's like that element of it, but then there is of course also the element of something being like your best ever standard. If the thing that you do now is the best ever standard that you ever do, then there's a real problem. There's a real problem. Our coaching now is infinitely better than it was 5 years ago because we've learned, we've improved, we've taken on client feedback, things have changed. We adapt what we do. I adapt the way that I do social media. I adapt the way that I do calls with people. I adapt Binge Breakthrough, all of these things. They adapt over time because we learn. And so nothing is ever perfect because it can always be better. But the only way to get it better is to do things and learn from it and then do it again. Perfectionism to some degree can be adaptive, to some degree it can help us with high quality, but when it becomes maladaptive and it pushes us into an inaction, it's a quality that you cannot afford to have as a business owner. And I do find sometimes that that is one of the things that sets people apart from being like, a business owner, entrepreneur, and a coach who always has just enough, but is kind of constantly trying to do more.
Yeah, I mean, I've definitely been stuck in the past, whether it's perfectionism, whether it's like the fear of it not being good enough or what other people might think. But I mean, how else do you learn? How else do you grow unless you take action? Yeah, I think sometimes it's, well, a bit like the fear self-compassion when you don't want to go to the gym, but you know you feel better for doing it anyway. It's exactly the same thing in I'm going to do the hard thing, even though it feels really uncomfortable.
And I think the accountability is really helpful. Again, I was having a conversation with the fantastic coach this morning who used to feel like she was saying today how she just feels like she always thought where she's at now would be the limit of her work capacity. But now, because she's released so much of the energy that she was putting into things that felt like they were taking so long because there was a lot of pressure, because she was had some other things like for herself that she was working through. Now she's like, oh, now I can do so much more. I've got time and energy that I'd never expected to ever have. And some of that in part is down to that, well, it used to take you X amount of time to do this specific thing. And the more accountable you are just to getting things done and setting yourself or, working with Anna, whatever accountability you have with your business, where you set yourself, okay, I'm going to do this week and this by then. One of the things that comes out of BTPHD mentoring more than anything else is the accountability of regular check-ins with us. And like some of the people that I work with will be like, oh, this is me. Like they do, they'll either do a loads of the stuff that we've set on the first day when we have the call, or a huge amount of them on the day before our next call. And that's
I'm
like,
not saying which one I fall into.
or sometimes both, right? And it's just that accountability. So if you're working with Anna in the mentoring capacity, then definitely use that. But if you're not, then find that way of accountability for yourself. Okay. When your feelings feel too big to sit with and your normal go-to is to eat, is there a healthier way to deal with them rather than this avoidance of them completely?
My go-tos are going for a walk or doing some yoga. Because I mean, as great as it is to learn to sit with those feelings, like there are some times where you're just like, this feels a bit too much. But for me, and I realize both of those are like movement based, but it might be you do something like creative and a bit like what we were saying in the beginning and getting those feelings out on, you know, painting or scribbling or whatever. But for me, it's a way of like channeling those feelings and staying present and just seeing, I guess, like how they feel in my body as well.
Yeah, I think when they're really big feelings, I would take the pressure off, like having to digest and regulate and in the moment. Personally speaking, I often will distract. If they're really big feelings, I will distract for a while, and then I will start to intentionally try to meet them or feel them. So I'll start doing things like force myself to journal or force myself to do, a slower yoga, force myself to talk about it, whatever it may be. And then I'll be intentional potentially with like slowing down, and then eventually it will come out in some way, probably at a time that's completely not related, probably in response to something that was completely trivial, and then everything will just fall out of me, and then it's like great. For me, when they're really big, heavy emotions, that is this way that feels safe to me to do it, because there's always the intention and the knowing of I am going to deal with these. But if they're really big and you've spent a long time in avoidance, I think it's almost like unreasonable sometimes for some people to just expect yourself to go, okay, I'm just going to sit, I'm just going to feel it, I'm going to process it right now, I'm going to deal with them right now. Because that's not necessarily like, maybe over time, repeatedly doing this work, it becomes slightly more easily accessible. But you don't always feel something in the moment, and like you have your response to something. Something happens, you have your response, and then you can like choose your reaction, right? And the reaction is not always in that moment the most logical thing. And it might be like that you take a bit of time to do it. So I think take the pressure off kind of going, okay, I feel this, so I'm going to behave in this way right now and regulate it in this way. And more, okay, this feels really heavy, I know something's there. Am I ready to start kind of encourage myself to process that? Or actually, maybe I'll find a slightly more helpful distracting tool for now. I'll go for coffee with my friends or watch Friends or whatever it is, for now. But I'm going to hold myself accountable to, in the next couple of days, I am going to do that journaling session, or I'm going to just sit with myself or go for a walk without any distractions and stuff like that.
Is there a best slash good way to figure out what is authentically you in terms of likes and dislikes, etc.? When you've come from a family environment where you've always struggled to fit in with the pack and you end up in a pattern of desperately trying to people please to earn love. I know that running is a true love of mine, but when it comes to things like food and other activities, I can't tell if it's something I actually like slash love or if it's just been conditioned to think and feel that way.
Oh, at first I thought we did this question last week because we were talking a lot about the fit being authentically you. I think the answer probably is not a definitive answer, but it's curiosity of doing the things and seeing how they make you feel in your body and how they make you feel in your mind. And if we take an example of, okay, you've always gone out drinking because that's culturally what you've always done, your friends have always done it, etc. And that was just felt like friends always wanted to do that. So you kind of were like, yeah, sure. And then you start to question that and think, oh, I don't know if that's what I want to do. Go out to the pub or whatever, to have that type of night, but get curious about how you feel before it. Get like sit, be mindful in your experience of it and think, am I enjoying this? What does joy feel like in my body? And then the next day, get curious again, like, how do I feel? How do I feel on reflection of that? And then have thinking of an alternative of, okay, maybe I want to try something else other than going to the pub with my friends. So I'm going to suggest that we actually go for a coffee and go for a walk. We have like a day date with friends. And again, before, during and after, get curious, like, how does this feel to me? And you have to be mindful, I think, if you come from that background of slight people pleasing, that you're not mistaking your contentment at people pleasing for joy. So when you do find things that genuinely bring you joy, so I think this, what did this person say, that they running, they get genuine joy from that. So you know what that feels like. So what different feelings does that evoke in you, and how does that feel in your body with that versus people please it? Notice when you people please in some way, shape or form, how does that feel? Is it like one leads to more excitement, one feels more like contentment, whereas one feels a little bit more resigned or passive, and start to learn difference of how those feelings show up for you.
But I guess, like, in terms of the well, this can be true for activities too, but I was thinking in terms of like food preferences as well, I would treat it in the same way that you might around kind of the food rules. And like, am I choosing this because I feel I should, or am I choosing this because I actually want to eat it? And maybe it's saying, like, if you were going out for a meal, like scanning the menu, and what two or three things stand out to you the most, and like you said, approach it with curiosity and see. And maybe it's saying, do you know what, I'm going to move away from what I normally choose and see how much enjoyment, hopefully enjoyment, I get from this meal instead. So you start to build up a bit of like a log of, okay, these are the things that I really enjoy. Like, some of them might be the things that that have been passed on from you from growing up, but you still actually enjoy them. And it's just, yeah, being curious and finding out.
The sober movement, is it calorie control, or is it alcohol, or is alcohol really as demonic as people make out? We've had a similar question to this before recently around, like, for one person, how could they tell if it was calorie control, right? Or how could they tell if it was health? Nothing is demonic. You might be demonic when you drink alcohol, don't know. But nothing is demonic. I appreciate the question. Alcohol's not healthy. Like, no amount of alcohol is good for you as a standalone drinking alcohol. Does alcohol potentially support your lifestyle and add to your healthful connections, allow you to be more mindful, or support you in being mindful of, you know, enjoying a meal out? Or does it offer like, I'm talking mindful consumption of alcohol here, maybe it's a bit of social lubrication and that feels helpful for you. I'm not saying that everyone should rely on that. That's another discussion for another day. It can absolutely, moderate alcohol can absolutely be part of an overall healthful lifestyle. But as a standalone, it's not like that kind of narrative of, oh well, alcohol, like up to 14 units a week, which is like the amount that's like the top from the NHS for women, is fine. Even moderate consumption, we think, is long-term health-wise, is probably not great. Some research came out earlier this year or last year looking at alcohol, it was last year, I think, looking at alcohol intake and health outcomes. So you just have to look at it in terms of your intent behind it and how it adds to your life or how it takes away from your life, and that might change over time. There have been times where I knew that I had to stop drinking because I had anxiety and it was just an escape. And then there are other times where I really love a few glasses of wine a week and they really add to my life.
I feel like what I'm seeing, that there seems to be a shift in, it's no longer kind of sober curious, it's like sober is the way that you should be going, and I don't like that at all. And the last question we had about this, obviously you were talking like moderation is did you say sexy, like I feel that, but that to me is, I mean, it's going back into that all or nothing thinking, and it's very much finding what works for you in terms of like alcohol consumption. And if I am completely honest, obviously we were away last week, and typically I'd be away and I'd be like, oh, I'll have a glass of wine in the evening, because even though we were still working, because it's nice and sunny, and I genuinely, for me, didn't feel like I needed it, didn't really want it. And that to me was like, okay, there's, yeah, maybe it's more like, I think I relate alcohol to like winding down and relaxing, and like I enjoy a glass of wine in front of the fire in an evening, but turns out I don't actually need it. I can just like do some yoga and feel great as well. So it's just staying curious, I think.
Yeah. I've definitely found in my pregnancy, like initially I really was like, oh, I really want a glass of wine so bad. And now that I'm at the point where I'm like, I know that I could have, you know, a glass of wine or whatever if I want one, I miss it much less. And the longer you go without something, I think the less you miss it. I'm not talking about food specifically here. I definitely don't think you should just be cutting out food, obviously. But yeah, I sort of feel a little bit like that. But then the other part of me is like, I do think it's, so I associate, you know, like sunset on holiday with my best friend with like an Aperol spritz, and I'll still be doing a version of that this year because it's like, it's a core memory that we have every year. And yeah, and that to me is never going to be demonic.
Yeah, I have to say the balcony, I was like, do you know what, some Lays and a gin and Fanta lemon, that would go down very nicely. But
discussion saws. They don't have Tanqueray 0% in I also wouldn't trust their measures if I'm like, okay, can I have like one drink? I don't know if I would trust their measures. Okay.
What does new research show about protein that means we need to prioritize it now, even though prior generations seem to have been living well and into their 90s? E.g., my grandpa, who died aged 99 and was doing his gardening pretty much up to this point. What is it doing for my health that I'm not gaining or avoiding if I didn't have so much?
The kind of more modern research that we base protein recommendations around, like, you know, 1.2 to 2 grams per kilogram body mass per day, is more related to muscle mass more than anything else. And muscle mass is actually one of the biggest predictors of longevity and health and mortality than anything else. So you might think, well, I don't really care about muscles from the gym or anything like that, but as we hit as we get older, and as women, when we hit perimenopause, our ability to maintain muscle gets blunted, and our anabolic response to protein and to exercise gets blunted. And especially as women with lower muscle mass, all genders with lower muscle mass were at greater risks of falls, poorer recovery from falls, and like I said, mortality, longevity, i.e. our risk of death. I wish I could remember the specific research paper, but it looked at literally, you know, muscle mass correlated with mortality. So it's very important. And it's not that that wasn't true 100 years ago, not that you're granddad is 100, but like, something that wasn't true, it's just that we didn't have the research yet. And what's likely back in, you know, maybe the 40s, 50s, 60s is that, I don't know what the dietary pattern was like, but it probably was like they tended to follow more traditional, like square meals. They'd have like their meat and their meat and their carbs and their veg, etc. at night. And they probably were eating sufficient protein for health, which is 0.8 grams per kilogram body mass per day, which is what, like, you know, the BDA recommends for protein intake, which is only, you know, upwards of what, 50 grams plus per day, depending on your body weight, which is quite easy to hit just by eating kind of three meals a day with protein in them. You know, eggs on toast, chicken sandwich, and then some meat and potatoes for dinner. You've probably met that. So again, and it's not also saying that if you don't eat protein, you're going to die younger, but we just know now that in order to kind of maximize our muscle protein synthesis, support our body composition, and I say that again not from aesthetics point of view but from a health point of view, that that amount of protein that we recommend now, again upwards of 1.2 grams, usually a bit more than that, and depending on your body weight, is optimal for maintaining muscle mass. And then, and also on top of that, all of the other roles that protein plays within our body, in regards to enzymes, cell structure, etc., etc. All of our cells require protein or are made of protein. Okay. Okay. So I found that as my relationship with food improves, my relationship with body image decreases. It'd be good to hear more about this. I hadn't appreciated it. It was something that's common because you set expectations in your head. Not quite sure what this person means. It's one of somebody that works the Roz. I wouldn't say it is common, but I wouldn't say that it's wrong. And the reason I wouldn't say it's common is that we know that more positive body images associated with reduced disordered eating in the research and people that we work with. It's one of the reasons it's a pillar of ET PhD. But it doesn't mean that that's not your experience. And it doesn't, again, it doesn't mean, definitely doesn't mean you're doing anything wrong. It just means this is your experience. I would question, I would ask you to get, encourage you to get curious about what improving your relationship with food, what else is going on there. And what I mean by that is, are you improving your relationship with food, but at the same time you're feeling like, actually, although you're being more relaxed around food, you feel like you're losing control? Or, and then when that happens, do you feel more anxious? Like, again, this is an example, this is me not saying this is what you're going through. As you're improving your relationship with food, is your body, are you gaining weight? And do you associate weight gain with negative things toward feelings towards your body? And it's not that the weight gain is impacting your body image, but it's your thoughts and feelings around that weight gain that's potentially impacting your body image. So yeah, it's not a direct, a more difficult relationship with your body is not a direct outcome of improving your relationship with food. So I would just get curious about what else is happening there.
Yeah, I see this in clients coming from a restricted background, clients coming from maybe like off the back of competing, clients working to restore their cycle. And again, like you said, for some people, relationship with food and body image, like, a lot of the time, it correlation, like, as one improves the other. But I think sometimes there can be that expectation on maybe what they think their body should look like during this process. And particularly if you are maybe feeling that loss of control, you're becoming more aware of what's going on for your body. And it might be a case of actually like holding myself accountable to what am I doing to support my body image? Am I becoming hyper aware? Am I body checking more frequently? And obviously Roz will be here to support that side of things. Because it sounds as though you're already doing fantastic work in noticing that progress in relationship with food, but if you're always going to trying to control your body, there's a limit to how much work you can do.
Three.
Maybe not relevant, always relevant, but how to deal with health anxiety. I find myself ruminating on all sorts of health worries, and I do book doctor's appointments, but sometimes I think it fuels it more. Any ways of figuring out when something is a valid worry or not?
This is a mental health query, I would say. So if it's accessible to you, then I would speak to a GP or speak to a therapist about this, or a counsellor. Because health anxiety, like I said, is a mental health condition. I actually think that's going to be my only piece of advice, because I'm very mindful of saying, oh, you know, just ask yourself what could be there. And I think it's important, right? You could say, oh, you know, ask yourself, like, am I immediately going to the worst case scenario? But at the same time, the reason why I'm mindful of even saying that is because I never, ever, I don't know how this has shown up for you on an individual basis. And I never want to discourage somebody, especially a woman who we're often having our experiences invalidated anyway. I never want to discourage you from seeking medical advice when you feel like you need medical advice. So even me saying, you know, consider all the potential contributors to this, or consider the likelihood of these things, or consider what else is going on for you when you notice that your health anxiety is worse. I think these things are all potentially important, but I don't feel that it's the right thing for me to say, or for us to say, to not seek advice as often. I think speak to a medical professional about that. Okay. How important is BMI? I'm currently classed as obese. I don't think I am, as I'm quite tall, and one of my goals is to get into the overweight category and eventually normal, but that seems like it's very far away at the moment.
BMI can be a useful guide, but it also doesn't take into account muscle mass and things like that. So for me, it's about taking it with a pinch of salt.
I'm going to disagree. I'm going to disagree, yeah. But I think it's important. I actually think it's really important, because I do think that for a lot of people, I think that's exactly right. We know that, like, we get what we call like a J-shaped curve with BMI and all-cause mortality. What that means is, at very low BMIs and then at higher BMIs, it's like a J shape, we see increases in all-cause mortality, death by all causes associated with BMI. I went to a talk once with someone, and he said, you know, if we remove smokers, etc., from this, like, it's that changes somewhat, because that tends to reduce BMI, and so we see those the increased risk of all-cause mortality and lower weights potentially associated with things like behaviors like smoking. But we do see this J-shaped curve. Ultimately, there is no denying the relationship between BMI and all-cause mortality, because of things like associations with like certain behaviors, but mostly because of the physiological occurrences that come with changes in BMI. Can you have an overweight or an obese BMI and still be metabolically fit? Yes. Can you have an overweight or obese BMI and be healthier than someone in a lower BMI? Yes. Realistically, most of us don't have sufficient muscle for BMI to be massively impacted. You know, if you're on a bodybuilder that's been on steroids, or if you're a rugby player or a professional athlete, who have significantly more muscle mass, or if you've been training for a very long time, maybe you have PCOS, so it's a lot easier for you to build muscle. You might find that your BMI is on the heavier side, but your body fat levels are still like healthy. So for sure there are some exceptions there. And there are some issues with BMI in the sense of like the people population that it's based on, a lot of the research that it's based on, predominantly white people, for example. But ultimately it is important. And when we look at things like medical treatments, IVF, fertility, these types of like fertility treatments, when they have BMI cutoffs, like those, that is for a reason. It's hard because there's that side of things, and then there's also like the weight bias side of things, where people just assume that if you have a BMI of X, that means Y. You are unhealthy, you don't do healthful habits, you're all of these things. And that's weight bias and weight stigma, and that's not okay. And that's sort of a different discussion. There are physiological adaptations that come with being in a larger body that will increase your risk of all-cause mortality and potential negative health outcomes. So, but suppose an important disclaimer is, as long as you're working on your health and you're like, you don't want it to be like, I'm doing these things so I can change my BMI category. Because all the work that you're doing, regardless of whether your BMI is changing or not, or your category is changing, all the work you're doing is going to be vastly improving your health. You know, so that is a standalone. Even if your body weight doesn't change and you're doing all of these healthful behaviors, is such an important thing. And it's so great that you're doing that for your health. And again, might be putting in you into a healthier space than someone in a lower BMI who doesn't do any of these things. So it doesn't negate anything if your BMI is not within the quote unquote healthy range, whether it be too high or too low. But again, on the flip side of that, if we're looking at low BMI, we know that that's really negative, or that has potential negative outcomes on your health as well. And so we would never recommend, you know, try and stay in a BMI under the healthful range, which at the moment is 18.5 to 24.9. I usually would err towards 20 to 24.9, especially for women. But again, you've got that helpful reach.
Okay, so I am 42 and recently went out for a date night with my partner. After a meal, we popped to a bar, which was when it happened. I suddenly realized how old I am. I felt old and it was a real shock to the system. Have you ever experienced anything similar? And how do you navigate wanting to still be trendy, which probably isn't even a cool phrase now? Nowadays, whilst not looking like mutton dressed as lamb.
You 100% will not look like mutton dressed as lamb. 100%. I kind of make a joke about it because I definitely feel like this. It's one of the reasons I don't like going out particularly anyway. But just before I stopped going out, like the pandemic probably did me a lot of favors because I still was going out quite a lot then. I was probably, I don't know how old I was, but I was still going out quite a lot then and loving it. And but I was definitely on the cusp of noticing that I was older than people. And then the pandemic hit, and then after that I didn't really go out as much ever anymore. But I definitely felt it when I did, for sure. It's less about the clothes that I wore and more just I was just aware I was older, and I was like, oh, what is this? And it wasn't judgment, it was more like, this just makes me feel older than I am. I kind of make a joke of it. Like the sock thing that I talk about all the time, that I learned on TikTok about wearing your socks, not wearing trainer socks. Like, I kind of like being like, I'm a millennial, I'm just trying really hard to be trendy. And I don't mind. Like, I think for me, there's a bit of an irony in it of like just kind of, it's not, you're not taking the piss out of yourself by any means. But I see stuff on like things like TikTok or podcasts or whatever where I listen to and I know what Gen Zers wear. But I'm also kind of like, what can I adapt from that that makes me like stay in touch a little bit if I want to, like the socks or the Sambas or whatever? And I'm like, okay, those things are on trend, and I can wear them with my usual style, but there's like a little nod to the Gen Zers in there. So I'm like, yeah, I know what's going on. Don't you worry about me. But I don't sacrifice my own style. I say that, I struggle to say it because I'm like, I know what I wear. I got a couple of things the other day actually. A maternity jumpsuit, and a couple of things. And I sent them to my best friend, and they were from Free People, which is like my favorite store, but it's not cheap. So I buy things like now and again, and there are things that I keep, and there are things that people always comment on when I wear them. She was like, oh, they're very you and very Free People-y. And I'm like, that is like, that's fine, that's my style, and that style is beachy baggy, and that's fine. But for example, the Eat a PhD event this weekend, I'll probably wear my maternity jumpsuit, but I'll probably also wear my long socks with my Adidas Sambas or my Gazelles, and there you go, there's my nod to Gen Z. But I'm still wearing my big baggy comfortable things that feel good on me. So I think that's personally how I navigate it. And again, I just make a joke about it. The number of times I've mentioned wearing longer socks on this podcast in the last year is ridiculous, because I think it's ridiculous that I'm even looking on TikTok to find out what a 25-year-old tells me to wear. But I am, because I'm a loser and I think that's okay.
I'm just sat here so smug that I didn't even realize it was a Gen Z thing. I'm just here trying to like help my Reynards.
Here, you're just naturally Gen Z.
I've made it. But it made me chuckle when you're like, what can I do to kind of give a nod to what's fashionable? I don't know when I stopped caring, but if I like something, I'll wear it. If in my head, if it looks nice, great. And then I'll go out and be like, oh, maybe other people are wearing these things. That's also fine. And I do think that that comes into it in like wearing stuff that makes you feel good and not trying to just fit in with what everyone else is doing. No offense to you.
No, it's true. Like, my mum is so fashionable, and she always used to buy Vogue, and she's very glamorous and just impeccable a lot of the time. And I think there's an element of that where, like, I used to work in Topshop, and I was always on trend, and I actually do enjoy it. I just don't enjoy it enough to sacrifice comfort and like my own style. So it's like that for me. It's like, I'm not doing it so that people don't think I'm old. I'm doing it because I am interested in these, and like, I do like it. I think it's fun. So yeah, I think you just kind of have to try and take a little bit of a lighthearted approach to it, and yeah, just laugh at it a little bit, because that's what's what fashion's supposed to be, fun. It's supposed to be like expressing yourself, right?
I follow I don't this is the thing. I don't even know what the account is called, but it's like it just shows you like what different people are wearing in New York, like just out on the streets, and you're like, do you know what? It really doesn't matter, because it's how they're wearing it and like the confidence that they bring. You're like, yeah, who even cares what any of us are wearing when
Yeah.
it's all about feeling good.
I agree. Okay, the last question. That's me in it. I'm feeling so lost. I'm looking at all the questions and I'm like, okay, this is a food question. always up for some high protein veggie breakfast suggestions.
Whenever anyone says a veggie, I always just like think savory, but obviously like whey is veggie as well.
Roast Greek
I
yogurt.
mean, someone.
Sorry.
I was going to say someone posted in the Telegram group what looked like a fantastic pancake, protein pancake recipe.
Yeah.
That looked insane.
Okay.
And also their kicking skills. Cooking skills, I'm very envious of because my pancakes do not ever look that good.
Same.
Yeah.
I got the last couple of weeks before we went to Malta, I got really into frittatas. Now I was having some for with my dinner, but I think they're a good breakfast. I think Lucy Lord's got a good frittata recipe on her website, I think. I would say that, by the way, if you're not on Lucy's email list, go on Lucy's email list. I thought, like, if you don't know who she is, we all probably follow her, Lord Lucy. And if you click on her, click on the link in her bio, like she does. Every week, it sounds like a sales pitch, but every week she sends out a Friday Supper Club email and it's got like three incredible recipes on it. And they're always things that you have or you can easily get. And they're really good. So and she doesn't put calories and macros and stuff on there, but she is mindful that a lot of people want to eat protein and so they do include those things. So yeah, omelets, frittatas, I always just have protein oats. So at the moment, also sometimes I have Greek yogurt with half a scoop of collagen, with tahini, honey, prunes, some sort of berry, whatever I've got, and then like a sprinkling of like a seed, like a flaxseed super seed mix type of thing that you get from Aldi or Lidl, or you can get them other places, but they're much cheaper in Aldi or Lidl. I really love that. Especially with like a hot cross bun on the side, or I've just had a hot cross bun and then I'll have that. I very much enjoy that. And I think I'm kind of out after that. Veggies,
My
sausages and eggs.
oh yeah, veggies and beans. But my like if I've got the time, and this is maybe like more of a weekend one, I'm gonna say this wrong, shakshuka,
Oh,
like
yeah.
the baked eggs in like tomatoey veggie
Do you make that? Good for
yeah.
you.
If I'm on it, because I'm like. Basically, just like a ratatouille. That's my way of thinking. So if I do that, and then I can just heat it up and put the eggs in, and then it's
For you. Respect for that. And then if you get like some wee like tortillas and put, that would be good. Also like a bagel. Bagels have got like 9, 10 grams of protein in them. So bagel with a couple of scrambled eggs. Some cheese. I'm really into cheese toasties at the moment too. Get sliced tiger bread, a wee toasty bag, stick it in the toaster, just a basic white cheese toastie. Top notch.
Finishing this podcast hungry again. I'm not hungry,
Oh
but
no, I'm hungry, but that's because I'm always hungry. Okay. Thanks for your great questions, everyone. Keep them coming in. Thank you so much, Anna.
thanks.
Bye. Thanks so much for listening. I hope you enjoyed it. And as always, if you did, please do feel free to like, share, subscribe, and review. And if you would like to chat to me, then you can find details of my Instagram in the show notes.